When you're a police officer, one of the things you learn as part of your training is that there's no such thing as a routine encounter or a regular traffic stop. In most cases, you don't know the person you're about to interact with, or if they have a criminal history, or how desperate they might be. My guest today, Daryl, found that out the hard way. He was a rookie officer working the morning shift on a weekend, and he wasn't necessarily expecting anything exciting to happen. But then he unknowingly crossed paths with a career criminal who had recently escaped from prison, and that man was determined to do anything to avoid being captured. Real people in unreal situations.
There is a man standing in front of me in my bedroom.
My friend has been shot.
I'm literally inside the river, and I'm inside my car.
He had told me multiple times that he was going to set himself on fire.
If you say my name or try to look at me, I'm going to kill you.
And he was just sobbing. He said, Mom, tell me you're going to be okay.
And I jumped on the hood of the car, and I held on.
And I looked into the garage, and he was hanging from the rafters.
I had somebody standing on my neck.
He's better to me dead. I want him dead.
I'm Scott Johnson, and this is What Was That Like? Hey, it's Scott, and guess what? You're about to hear an ad. And that's both good and bad. It's good because ads are what make it possible for me to keep bringing you these episodes. And it's bad because, well, maybe you don't like listening to ads, and I get that. And the good news is, you don't have to. When you sign up to support the show, you get every single episode without any ads. Plus, you get all the bonus episodes. Yeah, did you know there are actually bonus episodes? And you can try it all for free just to see what it's like. If you're on an iPhone, just go to the What Was That Like podcast and at the top, click on Try Free and you're in. On Android, just go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus and try it out completely free. Once you've had the ad-free experience, you'll see why hundreds of other listeners are already doing it. But for now, here's another ad, and then on with today's episode. I'll confess, sometimes I let my podcast playlist get out of hand and I get way behind. But there's one show that I subscribe to, and any new episode goes right to the top of the queue. That's the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's because I never have to figure out, okay, is this one going to be interesting or do I wait for the next one like I do for some shows? Because Jordan's conversations are always a must-listen for me. He talks to fascinating people from any category you can think of. Authors, scientists, athletes, you name it. He's talked to undercover cops who posed as mafia and the actual career mafia hitmen. And the stories he gets out of these people, just incredible. In one episode, he talked to Paul Holes. You might know that name if you're into true crime. He's the former investigator who uses really advanced methods to solve cold cases, including the Golden State Killer. And another one I really enjoyed was with Sam Harris, an author and neuroscientist who promotes skepticism, and he doesn't mind taking on some seriously controversial topics like politics or religion. That one's going to make you think. Whenever a new episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show pops up, I already know it's going to be an episode that I'll enjoy listening to, and I'll bet you will too. For some episode recommendations, check out jordanharbinger.com/start, or search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. How old were you when you decided to become a police officer?
When I actually decided I was going to start testing and whatnot, I was probably about 19 years old and obviously too young to test because you had to be 21 back then. I had tested with LA before I tested with Denver. And that's actually a different, kind of a neat story because I have a cousin that's a cop in LA. And he told me, he said, go take the test at all these little police departments and you're going to fail them all. And he was right. And he says, then go to LAPD and take their test and you'll be ready. And they were right because he was right because when I did go to LA, I got accepted. So then I had to make a decision. Do I want to live in LA or come back home to Denver? So I came back to Denver and I did the same exact thing.
What was the reason for failing at all of the little departments?
Well, you don't really know what they're looking for, okay? And usually the little departments pattern their tests after the home rule of PD, like Denver. You know, I went to Arvada and to Aurora, Lakewood. And in California, I went to Torrance and all those little police departments. It was true. You bomb out. I mean, it's you don't know what they want. And then you start getting the idea what they want. And it worked. I can tell you that.
So you had been a cop for a couple of years, this thing that we're going to talk about that happened in Denver. And how old were you at that point?
I think I was 21 or 22, because I came on in 1970 and I got shot October 3rd of 71.
So just almost a couple of years then.
Yep. I was a rookie.
Take us through what happened that day. This was, you were doing the morning shift and it was on a Sunday.
Kind of a chilly time, and I was part of my precinct was projects, and I had just gotten a twist and chocolate milk at Winchell's, and I was going to 44th and LePan to Sunnyside Drug to get a Sunday paper, and I was going down Mariposa Way when I spotted this little black Chevy, and there was two females in it, and the passenger was a male, and he had this weird Castro hat on. You know, the hat that Castro always wore, and it had some buttons on it. And he looked like a tough guy. So I got nosy, and I pulled around and got behind him and walked up to the passenger side and ID'd him. And I asked him for his driver's license. And he acted like he could only speak Spanish. And I didn't believe him, of course. But he had a coat laying across his leg. And I took that off and put it on the top of the car. He pulls a wallet out, and in the wallet, he had some pictures of some children and a Social Security card with the name Luis Archuleta on it. So I get him out of the car, and I'm going to pat him down because this guy, he looked like a con.
So I gotta just ask you this. You at this point, you were interrogating him or asking him questions just based on instinct, right? Or did you have did you need a reason back then to stop somebody?
Not really.
So they wouldn't, it's different today then, obviously.
Oh yeah. It's different today because they want you to have probable cause and whatnot. And back then your probable cause was the guy looked like a character, you know, and now he's producing a Social Security card and he doesn't have a picture ID. He had joint tattoos. So anyways, get him to the back of the car and I tell him to put his hands on the trunk. And rather than do that, he turns sideways and he's shuffling down the trunk with his butt towards the trunk and his right elbow is going up. Well, I was real close to him. So I decided, well, I'm going to hit him and tried to get the gun away from him. So I hit him in the temple, knock his glasses, his sunglasses and hat off. And stupid here, I reach across his body and he's got a revolver. I'm really no match for him. You know, what I didn't know was is that he was pumping iron in the penitentiary, and, you know, he was a beast. So he levels the gun, pulls the trigger, and I go down. He's running off, and I've got my gun, but I don't shoot the guy. There's kids and people around, because that's what they do. They watch what you do when you make a stop in the projects. So anyway, I had to crawl to the car because we didn't have radios that came out, you know, like they do today.
Oh, so you had to get back to your car just to radio for help.
That's right. And secondly, we didn't have bulletproof vests, and that's why I took one in the nine ring. So
where is that? What's that section?
Well, imagine a body target and 10 is your heart area. 9's the next area around it. 8 is around that. And it, you know, it goes out from the heart on out. So it was the 9 ring, and we say the 9 ring. So what we didn't know at that time was that he was an escapee from California. He had escaped from a penitentiary there. And he was doing time with a certain individual that told him, well, go to Denver and you can hide out with my old lady. You'll be safe there. And that's why he was in Denver.
If you would have known that ahead of time, you probably would have approached him a little differently, right?
Oh, yeah. I'd have taken him at gunpoint and called for backup. You see, back in those days, the morning shift were solo cars. They weren't two-man cars. Something that I've never believed in. I always have felt that every shift should have nothing but two-man cars. So,
what did it feel like to get shot?
Oh, my goodness. It kind of knocked the wind out of me, and I couldn't get my legs to work. And I had to crawl to the car, and I was thinking, God, am I shot in the spine? I didn't know. And it wasn't really painful. It didn't get painful till later. So
maybe because of adrenaline?
Probably. So that was basically the shooting incident itself.
So you were probably out of commission for a while.
Oh, yeah, many weeks. And I was in the hospital for actually, I don't know if it was about 3 weeks or what, but the bullet did a lot of damage. And so, you know, I was lucky to be alive. Now, if I had to do over, knowing what I know now or 2 years later in my career, I would have backed up, pulled my gun, and shot it out with him. I'd have never hit him or tried to fight him. It was stupid on my part.
Yeah, but you were still a rookie.
That's true.
So he ran off, and so what happened from that point?
Well, the Crusade for Justice got him out of Denver and took him to Mexico. So he's down in Old Mexico, and he gets in trouble down there, and they have we've never been able to verify, but we think that he was involved in a shooting with a bunch of other guys that were dealing narcotics and, you know, just being kind of like rebels in a way. They were anti everything. And he gets caught and they're torturing him, supposedly. He later says that they had him sitting on ice blocks and beating him with a rubber hose and all this stuff. I don't know if that's true, but he got to an American consulate and says, hey, get me out of here. I shot a cop in Denver. And that's how we got him back. That's when we learned his real name was Lawrence Pusateri.
So he was being treated so badly in Mexico that he wanted to come back and be tried for shooting you.
Absolutely. That was the lesser of the two evils, and he thought that they were going to kill him. So we get him back, and we go to trial. He gets 9.5 to 14, and I didn't think that was a very big sentence, but that's what he got. And so down the road in 1975, he and a guy named Sidney Riley go to the state hospital. All the inmates in Colorado, if they have to have an operation or a procedure, they have to go to the state hospital in Pueblo. So anyway, they go there, and they go in, and I guess they asked to use the bathroom, and they had guns waiting for them. So they armed themselves. Now they have an accomplice that has a car there waiting for them. And they shackle up the two guards in the bathroom, and they make their escape.
This sounds like a movie.
No kidding. I agree. It's like a movie script.
So the whole thing, the whole hospital trip, they had all planned this all out, obviously, ahead of time.
Oh, yeah. They had it planned. It was orchestrated beautiful. You know, if I get a chance to talk to him, which I'm going to try to do when he hits Canyon City, he's in diagnostic right now, I'm going to congratulate him.
This escape during the hospital trip, would today's procedures have prevented that kind of escape?
I have no idea. You know how he escaped in California? He built a dummy in his bed so it looked like he was sleeping. He was at some camp, and that's how he escaped.
This guy knows how to get away.
He sure does.
Here's my hot take for today. If you see something advertised as a free trial, it might cost you more than you expect. At least that's my experience. I give up my credit card to try something for free for a week, then I forget about it, and now I'm paying for it every month without even noticing it. But when I signed up for Rocket Money, that ridiculous waste came to a screeching halt. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending, and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. It lets you see all of your subscriptions listed right there in one place. When you see a subscription you're paying for but you don't want, do you really want to spend an hour on the phone trying to track down some customer service agent to cancel it? Rocket Money can help you get rid of it with just a few taps. They also give me this great dashboard so I can see what I've spent this month compared to last month. And they'll even try to negotiate lower bills for me by up to 20%, so I'm spending less and saving more. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/whatwas. That's rocketmoney.com/whatwas. rocketmoney.com/whatwas.
I made a decision a long time ago. When I'm out riding my bike each morning and I cross paths with someone, I always smile at that person. And most people smile back. But I do it because even though it's a little thing, it makes a big difference for me and maybe for them. It's just a fact. Small actions can bring big benefits. In the same way, it's also true that taking care of your gut can support the health of the rest of your body. Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic benefits not just your gut, but your skin and heart health too. Seed DSO1 is part of my morning routine. If you can call it a routine, it's just two little capsules. And I feel amazing. It helps maintain the health of my heart, and it promotes regularity, which I can attest to. Sorry, that may be a little TMI there. For me, it's great that it's vegan, but it's also sugar-free, soy-free, peanut-free, gluten-free, and has no preservatives. It doesn't even need refrigeration. DSO1 has so many benefits, including the fact that it's backed by a lot of science, but I've barely scratched the surface here. What I can say, though, is that my body feels great, and I've got a promo code so you can see the benefits for yourself.
Trust your gut with Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic. Go to seed.com/what and use code 25what to get 25% off your first month. That's 25% off your first month of Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic at seed.com/what. Code 25what.
Hey, this is Scott. Did you know we offer a premium feed of this show that is completely ad-free and there are bonus episodes? Go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus or just click the link in the show notes of any episode to learn more and to sign up. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up right there in the app by clicking Try Free at the top of the episode list. And I hope to see you in the premium feed soon.
Yep.
So that must have been kind of discouraging for you to realize, wow, this guy shot me and now he's free again.
Yeah. And, I initially tried to find him and I really didn't think he'd be in Denver. I mean, it's not that we didn't look there and we contacted my informants and all that stuff and trying to find him. But I didn't think he'd go there, and I knew he wouldn't go back to Mexico, and I didn't think he'd go back to California where his mother is. And I was right, because the three states I thought he might have lit in, he did. So now Sidney Reilly, who escaped with him, was caught, I don't know how quickly, but it was pretty quickly. Of course, Fusateri, I mean, he's bragged when they arrested him and stuff, that he was on the run longer than anybody. Whitey Bulger was only on the run for 18 years. So.
So you didn't give up on tracking this guy down.
Oh, no. I made it kind of like a hobby. For these past 46 years, I'd contact my informants and family members of the gals that were in the car and just general bad guys, just so they would talk. And I know they were talking, saying that crazy Sin Cuana's still looking for the guy that shot him and all that. So anyway, it paid off.
I know for the rest of your career, you kind of kept track and tried to find him. But this, you're talking about even after you retired.
Oh, yeah. I just kept hammering away. I'm pretty persistent. It was June 24th of 2020, and I got the phone call. And this person said, I've been thinking about it, and I'm going to tell you where your guy is that shot you. And he did. I mean, he said, this guy's living in Espanola, New Mexico. He's running under the name of Ramon Montoya. He's married to Esther Chacon, and he gave me the address. So that's all the information he gave me. And
who was this guy?
I have no idea. Probably somebody that owed me. So I took that information and plugged it into my databases. And lo and behold, up he pops, Ramon Montoya. He had a phony date of birth. And there was Esther Chacon. There was the address he gave me. So, you know, I kept digging from there. And I found that he was arrested in, I think it was Henderson, New Mexico, in 2011 for DWAI. And I called them. And they couldn't or wouldn't give me a picture or his fingerprint card. They couldn't find his fingerprint card, by the way. So anyway, the picture, it was him. So I call this Lieutenant Abraham Baca at the Espanola Police Department. And I lay all this out to him and I send him all the information that I developed. And I developed more information than that. I found his first wife. When he first escaped, he married this Darlene Montoya that was from the Santa Fe area, had three kids by him. And when the FBI interviewed her, she says, I divorced him because he was mean and violent, and he sexually assaulted my daughter. And that's why she divorced him. I later called her, and she was really cooperative, and she says, I'm glad you survived meeting him because he's really dangerous. I also tried to call his other family, the Chacon family, except they didn't like me and they wouldn't talk to me. You know, they said I was heartless going after an old man that was sick and all this stuff.
I can't imagine you had a whole lot of sympathy for him.
No, I didn't. I didn't care. I don't care if they like me or dislike me.
It's pretty amazing that he stayed in the United States, though.
This guy, he's smarter than I ever thought. He was really smart to stay hidden for 46 years. Now, think about that, 46 years. Now, Darlene and one of the sons, Mario, said that he admitted that he shot a cop in Denver to them and that he'd been on the run and all that. And maybe it's true, but understand, he had a valid driver's license, a Social Security card, both under Ramon Montoya, not his real name, fake date of birth. And once you got that, when you got those items and they're real government IDs, how are they going to get you? They're only going to get you if you get arrested and they fingerprint you and they send the prints to the FBI and they run them. They have a computer and they can run them through that computer. And that's how they catch a lot of people.
Right, because they hit a match.
Yep. So anyway, I mean, you got to hand it to him. I mean, this guy stayed hidden 46 years.
Yeah, that's just incredible to me. And I would think, you know, from his standpoint, like maybe after 8 years or 10 years or something, he's probably thinking, hey, I'm okay. I'm clear. I got away with it. But then especially after 40 years or longer,
yep,
he's thinking there's no way they're ever going to catch me now.
It's true. That's true.
So this local police chief helped you out.
He wasn't a police chief. He was a lieutenant, and he did. The only thing he did that really upset me was he called in the FBI. First thing they did, they says, well, we want to debrief your informant. And I said, that ain't going to happen. Even if I knew who the informant was, I wouldn't let him near him. You know, I have a lot of experience dealing with the FBI, and I wouldn't let him near him.
And why is that?
Well, because they want to document him. They want to make him a witness. He may have to take the stand. They burn everybody, you know, and then they put him in witness protection or whatever. And I just wasn't going to play at their game. I know their game.
And you didn't know who it was anyway, so you couldn't have given him up.
I couldn't have given him up. I wouldn't have. Everything he gave me was right on. And then the information I developed from there was right on. You know, that's how we got him back. And at the time of his arrest, he told the FBI, the SWAT team and all that. He said, I don't know who you're looking for, but it's not me. So anyway, they had him show us his bare chest and arms, and there's the tattoos. You know, I got a picture of him in my book where he's got all those tattoos. And then his fingerprints, I mean, he wasn't going anywhere. When they arrested him, you know, they said he's sucking oxygen. Of course, we knew that because they saw an oxygen truck delivering oxygen to him. But I said, is he able to stand? Oh, yeah. I said, can he walk? Yeah, but he has a wheelchair. I said, it doesn't matter. I says, he's looking. He's planning another escape. Trust me. I mean, I know this man, and he is. He's going to try to escape again.
Man, you'd think at some point he would just give up and say, look, let's just let me just live out my days and not try to be on the run anymore.
No, that's no fun. I don't believe it.
When he was arrested, he was living there with his wife and some other relatives. But did that wife know about his past with you, or do you know?
No, she says that she had no idea that he was a fugitive, that he'd shot a cop. Now, she didn't tell me that. She told the FBI that in Espanola. So the other one, though, the other wife, she was very forthcoming with me, and she said she knew. But she was afraid of him. You know, in fact, when they first showed him a picture and said, do you know this person, or however the FBI did it, she denied it because she's afraid of him.
That's common, though, in an abuse situation, right?
Right.
So this guy, how old is he now?
I think he's 77. He's born in 43, his real date of birth.
Boy, what a life.
Oh, my goodness.
What is his current legal status?
Well, he's in what they call diagnostic. It's reception and diagnostic. And it's a building on Smith Road in Denver where everybody goes prior to being shipped to an institution like Canyon City or Buena Vista or one of the privately owned penitentiaries. So he's been there quite a while. Now, he went to a hearing recently, and they served a writ of habeas corpus, which my understanding, they would have had to bring him to the court. That's produce the body. So I tuned into that court that day, but I never got to see him. I wanted to see what he looked like. I mean, they got a picture of him on the Department of Corrections website. You can go there and see what he looks like. But he's got a oxygen thing in his nose. But the 2011 picture, now that's a good picture of him. The way I got that, I went to mugshots.com, and they had his picture, four of them, on that website when he got arrested in New Mexico.
And we'll have these pictures you're talking about. We'll have them in the show notes for this episode if people want to look at that. Yeah. He's in Denver.
Yes.
And you're in Denver. Can you just go visit him?
No. I have to wait for him to go to Canyon City. Then they have to send him a request, and he has to say, okay, I will meet with him. He can deny me access to him.
Do you think he'd want to meet with you?
I don't know. I don't know what the upside is. And it may not be an upside for him.
He may just want to see this guy that's been chasing him for 46 years.
Yeah. Anyway, he's going to trial if he doesn't take a deal for the escape. And something I didn't know is that there are no statute of limitations on escape in Colorado. And secondly, when he escaped, the day he escaped, his time stopped. That 9.5 to 14, it stopped. And if he would have just stayed in jail, he'd have been out.
Long ago, he would have been.
Long ago.
Of course, somebody with his mentality, though, he would have done something and he'd be back in prison anyway.
Maybe. But he'd have done about 7 years and he'd been gone. He'd have been back in circulation.
Assuming that he says he's okay with meeting you, what do you say to him?
Well, I've thought about that. And what I was going to do, first of all, I was going to congratulate him for being on the run for 46 years. I mean, that is an achievement. And that's probably how I would start out the conversation with him.
A worthy opponent, so to speak.
Oh, he was really worthy, formidable, really hard to find. I'd have never found him if this person hadn't come forward.
Well, you have a book out. You had quite a career as a police officer.
I did.
And your book is called The Blue Chameleon, The Life Story of a Super Cop. What's the reference to the chameleon?
Oh, you'd have to read the book. But
that's a good little tease. I like that.
Yeah. What's cool about the book, the cover of the book is the shirt I was wearing the day I got shot. And after I got out of the hospital and stuff, I'm trying to think exactly when I went and got the shirt, but I did go get it and they gave it to me. And it has the bullet hole and the evidence tag still on it. So I made a book cover out of it.
That's a great idea. I love that.
It's different.
But you talk about, in the book, you talk about your career as a cop, and you were controversial,
very,
to say the least.
Very.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I started getting really good at being a policeman, and I had a knack for developing informants. I did all sorts of big cases, and I got a lot of publicity, and not that I looked for it, it just came. So I wrote a book. There was a lot of rumors and stuff, and I wanted to set the record straight about my career. There was rumors when I retired and stuff that I got fired and all that, and so I had to set the record straight, mainly to go on. So I wrote this book, and it turned out to be a great book. It's won a bunch of awards. And I'm just adding the 18th chapter, and that's Chasing Pusateri and he being arrested. And that whole chapter, I'm done with it. And I'm switching publishers. So as soon as I get a publisher, the next book will have that chapter in it.
Well, we'll put links to your website and where to get the book and all that stuff in the show notes for this episode so people can check that out. Daryl, I applaud you for your persistence in trying to catch this guy. I'm glad he's back in the prison where he belongs, and thanks for telling your story.
Well, thanks for asking.
If you want to find out more about Daryl and the book he wrote about his lifelong career as a police officer, check out his website, which is thebluechameleon.net. And I wanted to let you know about a few ways you can connect with me and the podcast that you might not be aware of. First up, do you get my emails? I send out an email every time a new episode comes out, and I'd love to include you in that. You can subscribe, and it's free, of course, at whatwasthatlike.com/email. And if you're on Reddit, and I know some of the listeners to this podcast are diehard Redditors, this podcast has its own subreddit. I think right now there are only about 100 people subscribed there, but it keeps growing steadily. That's at reddit.com/r/whatwasthatlike. And I also post something new and unusual on Instagram almost every day. And there are over 10,000 people following me there, which is at instagram.com/whatwasthatlike. And if that's not enough, you've heard me invite you already to our Facebook group, where we have about 1,200 podcast listeners having discussions about all kinds of stuff. That's at whatwasthatlike.com/Facebook. All right, so that should give you enough ways to stay in touch and keep up with what's going on. And to close out the show, something a little different. I get a lot of people contacting me with their stories to see if their story might be a podcast episode, and for the vast majority, I have to decline. And there are lots of reasons for this, which I won't go into right here. For a lot of them, the story itself might be really interesting, but for one reason or another, it's just not a good fit for an episode. So to end today's show, I'd like for you to hear a few of those. Take care. I'll see you in 2 weeks.
My father was in an accident involving a train when I was a child. He was out late with some friends and on his way home when he came upon an uncontrolled railroad crossing, which essentially means that there are no signals or gates. It's just a crossing kind of on a country road. And he didn't see the train approaching, so it hit him and he died instantly. My family really struggled with it. And to this day, I have not asked where it happened specifically. We don't talk about it often, and I know if I knew the location, I would never be able to cross the tracks again. But of course, every time I cross tracks, I wonder if those are the ones that it happened. But I'm working on healing from it, despite the fact that it's been 17 years now. It's still prevalent in my mind, and anytime I hear a train whistle or see railroad tracks, I think of him. One thing, strange thing about his passing was shortly before he died, we went to Six Flags as a family, and we were waiting in line, and they had the little sweepstakes that you can enter in the little plastic box, and he entered us in a free trip to Hawaii. And I've always wondered, do people even win those things? But for whatever reason, after he passed, we got a phone call and we had won, and we ended up spending approximately 2 weeks in Hawaii after he died. And he was the type of person that loved the beach. And I mean, in my eyes, it was a gift from him. And to this day, I will forever view it that way. I'm definitely looking for support groups if anyone else has been through something similar. Family members lost due to a car accident involving a train. You can reach out to me at amberrhasty@gmail.com. Thank you.
Visiting my Uncle Bob and Aunt Margie's dairy farm was something I looked forward to on our once-a-year family trip to the country. I loved the cows in the cornfield. Their dogs were a pleasure, too, since we didn't have any pets. Aunt Margie would cook up a great country supper when we visited. Uncle Bob once gave me and my sister a ride on the tractor, which was pulling a corn harvester through the field. It was exhilarating to watch the corn fly up from the stalk and fall into the large container behind the tractor to be brought to the silo. Those were the best days, and I wished I could live on a farm instead of the city. I had just turned 11 before this visit in the late 1950s, and it was getting late in the day, and we hadn't been to the cornfield yet. I wanted so badly to stand next to those tall stalks and maybe walk around a bit. The adults were sitting in chairs near the garden, and I stood in front of my father and asked, "Can I go for a walk in the cornfield?" He ignored me and kept conversing with Uncle Bob, so I stood in front of my mother and asked the same question. She wouldn't answer me. These were the days of children being seen and not heard. I decided it was getting late and we would be leaving soon, so I made the decision to go see the cornfield by myself. I walked past the silo and came to the gate in the fence. I unlatched it and walked through onto a dirt ground. The cornfield was in sight, and I took four steps toward it, and then my feet wouldn't move anymore. I didn't understand what was happening. I tried to turn around toward the gate, but my feet and legs wouldn't follow my upper body. I felt desperate and tried to reach the fence for something to hang on to, but it was out of reach. I was sinking fast in mud. I wondered how I could remedy this. Could I scream? My 11-year-old logic told me that my parents didn't hear me when I was standing right in front of them, so most likely they would probably not hear me now. The mud was up to the bottom of my chest, and I reasoned that soon I may need to hold my breath. I knew I could hold it for a long time because I practiced at the pool in town. I wondered how much further I would sink. The mud was up to my neck when suddenly I saw my cousin running toward me. A look of shock was on her face as she spun back around, leaving a trail of dust at her feet as she ran with all her might to get help. Soon, the only way to survive was to tilt my head back as far as I could and stare at the sky. I looked down my nose and saw my Aunt Margie running full blast toward me. And then I felt her hands reach in and grab my arms and pull my muddy body out of that sinkhole. My aunt hosed me off in the cow barn and explained that it had rained for 3 days and caused a sinkhole right where I stepped. When I asked if I would have drowned in that mud, she answered yes. Sadly, we never visited the farm again. It's no wonder I had nightmares and panic attacks.
Hi, this is James Clattenburg, and this story is about a small plane crash in the Turks and Caicos Island back in 1999, 92, I believe. So I went to the island with a friend, Dave, and we first went to Provo or Providenciales, and we were there for a few days, and this big storm came in. And we had already planned to go to Salt Key or Salt Cay for this middle part of the trip. And there was a pilot who was going to take us to this small little island. I think only about 60, 80 people, less than 100 residents anyways. So it was very stormy, and we met the pilot the day before, and he said, do you guys still want to go tomorrow? It's going to be very stormy, but, you know, we should be fine. So we said, sure. So we were staying at this small little hotel or guest house on Salt Key, and we got in contact with the guy because he was going to pick us up, the owner of the hotel or the inn, and then take us to the property. So we get on the plane that morning, and it was very windy, and it was a five-seater Cessna. And I believe there was only one door, and it was on the passenger side. So the pilot jumps in, then I get into the back, which is a row of three seats, very small seats. And my friend Dave gets in the front. So we take off, and it was extremely windy. I mean, granted, it was a small plane, and it was just, the plane was just bouncing all over the place. So I'm holding on to either side. And granted, this is only a 10-minute flight from Provo to Salt Key. So we start to land, and I'm not a pilot, but I know that you land against the wind, not with the wind behind you. So we can see this small little runway, which was basically, it looked like, I don't know how many feet long, but it was very small, and it was surrounded by barbed wire to keep out the donkeys and the wild bulls that roam this little island. So we're landing, and the wind is just pushing us so fast towards this runway. And so we basically just slam into the ground, and the pilot just says, oh shit. And he immediately turns the wheel, and the landing gear just collapsed. And we are scraping along sideways towards the end of this runway. And at the end of the runway, there's a row of barbed wire, like I was mentioning, to keep out the wild animals. So the propeller flies off. We're skidding, and it was sort of like being in a car in the snow where you don't, there's no control. You don't know when it's going to stop. And we're just skidding along, and all of a sudden the plane stops probably 10 feet short of the end of the runway. One wing is through the barbed wire, and then beyond that, there's a ditch. The pilot immediately unbuckles his seatbelt, jumps out over my friend Dave, who is a big guy, like football player guy, and and he runs down the runway and leaves us there. So we're stranded. We're thinking, oh my God, is this plane going to blow up? I mean, it all happened so quick. And we just slammed into that runway. And we both thought that the plane was going to, who knows, explode. So he runs off. We get out of our seatbelts. We get out of the plane. And, you know, we're running away from the plane. And we see the guy who owned the inn, who was there to pick us up. And he looks at us and he says, I have lived on this island for 15 years. I have never seen a plane come in so fast. He said, I thought you guys were goners. Now, would you like a cocktail or do you need to change your underwear? So I laugh about it now, but it was scary, 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 because it was just, it was funny. And then there were other things that happened on that particular island, like I was chased by a donkey and then I was sucked into the ocean. So in the end, we ended up laughing about it, but we called it Death Island because, so hopefully nothing like that will ever happen again. So, but anyways, that's my little airplane crash story.